And welcome to another edition of Book Talk. I'm Linda Lloyd, and today I'm talking with award-winning author Rhea Fry. Her new book, Not Her Daughter, has been listed as one of the summer's hottest books by Pop Sugar and is soon to be a major motion picture. You've been doing this for a while, right?
Yeah, I mean, this is the first, fiction. Yes, I've done radio, TV, things like that.
Okay.
Yeah.
I told Stephen I try not to watch or read too much about you.
Sure.
Or about the book.
Yeah.
Because I want to form my own opinions. But
absolutely,
then afterward.
Smart. Do you know how to pronounce it's Rhea Fry. It
Rhea
looks like
Fry.
Ray Frey, but it's Rhea Fry. I've thought about
spelling
it phonetically.
Actually, that was one of the reasons I looked you up.
Okay.
Because I wanted to make sure it wasn't Ray.
Yes, which I get called all the time.
How was it that I said it first?
I got Rhea.
Maybe I said Rhea, but it's Rhea.
It is Rhea.
It is Rhea Fry.
Rhea Fry.
And Fry shouldn't be that hard for people.
No, but it looks like Frey. I mean, it literally looks like Ray Frey, so I blame my parents completely.
Yeah. Let's think about that. Could that feed into this book anyway?
Yeah, right. No, actually, I had a wonderful childhood.
Okay.
I think people think I had a terrible childhood after reading this, but...
No, not necessarily. I wouldn't think so. But you did dedicate this to the girl with the red bow.
I did.
And as soon as I opened it, I thought, okay, that plays into it. And
absolutely.
Of course, when you first start reading, you don't know how. But who is the girl that you dedicated this to?
Yeah, so the girl with the red bow is a very real person. Actually, the premise of this book is based on something real that I saw in an airport. So the characters of Amy, who are the biological mother of Emma, the five-year-old, these two characters I witnessed in an airport. It's actually a scene that makes it into the book. Once I became a parent, I started noticing all of these parent-child behaviors. I'm a parent myself, and I've been the mom who's kind of yelling at her kids, and then I've been the mom who is like the best mom ever. And I think as a parent, you just, you know, you can't ever really judge someone else, especially when you're in public. But I think we've all been there where we've seen maybe a questionable parent-child behavior. And on one of my business trips, I happened to see this mother, again, who's based on the character in this book, Amy, and a little five-year-old girl in a red dress and a red bow and red shoes, and she looks so cute, and she wasn't doing anything, but her mother, it was just such a disturbing exchange. She was yelling at her. She began physically pushing and pulling her for no reason. I mean, it was almost like a caricature of a scene that was in front of me and these two people. And I found myself wanting to rescue this little girl. I just wanted to take her and give her 5 minutes to just be on her own and be okay and be calm. And I thought about her for months and months after. And I already had an idea for this book. I knew I wanted to talk about a reverse kidnapping. I knew my characters' names. I knew the little girl's name was going to be Emma. And this little girl in the airport, her name was Emma. I've got chills. I took it as a sign and I went home and I was like, I have to write this story. So it's very much dedicated to a real person. And I kind of always wonder if like the real mom read this someday and recognize herself, because I really did base it on physically what she looked like, what this little girl looked like. I kind of took that from real life and just ran with it.
Well, what would happen if she did?
I don't know. That's a great question. I mean, when I first saw the mother, my inclination was to empathize with her and say, hey, I know you're having a bad day. It's stressful. You're at the airport. We've all been there. But then as it got more physical and physically aggressive toward this little girl and knocking her down, and I just became very protective over her. So I don't know. I mean, I think I've kind of taken the question that I want readers to answer. Was this mom having a bad day, or is she a bad mom? And I want the reader to kind of think about that. And I guess that would be my hope, too, is not that it's a judgment call on her, but just kind of a deeper look at motherhood in general.
Well, and I have 5-year-old twin girls.
Oh, you do?
Yeah. And, well, of course, they're my granddaughters.
Yeah, yeah.
And when I was reading this, it's like, you know, they do push your buttons sometimes.
Yes, they do.
But Amy always felt like Emma was doing it on purpose.
Right.
Always.
Right.
Always on purpose. Is that realistic? Do 5-year-olds really have that much deviousness in them?
I mean, I don't think so. Unless you've read, I don't know if you've read Baby Teeth by Zoya Stage, but that is a creepy little kid. So there are children out there, of course, who are manipulative. But I wanted to kind of showcase that I think as parents, you know, kids can press our buttons. I think they do it unknowingly, though some, you know, they know exactly what to do and how to push your buttons. But they're also children. I don't think any child purposely tries to annoy their parents. But I find it very interesting that parent-child relationships can be so different and kind of toxic versus when you take that same child and put them at school or with a teacher or with an aunt or with a friend, and they can be the best child in the world and have zero problems. And that's kind of what I wanted to showcase in this book. Sarah, the kidnapper, her and Emma are kind of in this honeymoon stage. Sarah does not have kids. She is not a mother. She's very entitled to think that she kind of knows what's best for this child. And I feel like they're in this honeymoon stage. They're not in the day-to-day as moms and kids often are. So I don't think kids do things on purpose necessarily, but I do think we can react to our children and our children can react to us and the stress level of daily life. I think that plays into it more than anything.
And Sarah, really, she owns her own company, mm-hmm. and it is geared toward children.
It is.
By the way, how did you come up with the kits? I'd love to have some of those.
Well, it's funny. So my husband is a designer, and we have talked about, like, oh, wouldn't this be so cool to, like, come up with these digital activity books that are based on kids' preferences? And so I kind of just imagined the business that I would love to have for my own daughter and kind of ran away with it that way. But I think it'd be a really fun business for kids.
I think so, too.
Yeah.
And that's what Sarah was doing. I mean, she was interacting. Do you think when she went to the school and this same child that she's seen in the airport is there, do you think it was one of those moments where she went, this is Providence. I've got to do something.
Absolutely. And I kind of liken it back to when I saw this little girl in the airport in real life and her name was Emma, the same, you know, name I wanted to name my character. I'm like, this is meant to be. I have to do something about it. And obviously, Sarah kidnapping a child for good is very, very, very exaggerated. But I do feel like she thinks that she saw this child for a reason and that it was her responsibility to do something about it. I think her own past with her own mother plays a lot into that and why she does the things that she does in this book. She doesn't often make the best decisions, but I think absolutely she thinks it was divine that she was there and it was up to her to kind of make sure that this little five-year-old was okay.
Well, at first, mm-hmm. you know, in one of the scenes, I'm thinking, oh, this is something that just came to her.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
She's going to take advantage of a situation as it comes up. But it was really premeditated. I mean, she went back.
She did, yeah. So that's the thing. She's doing this to, in her mind, quote unquote, save this little girl. But it is still kidnapping. It is still wrong. She did put thought into it. Yes, she glimpses this girl for a second time a few months later. But she does then make a plan to go back to this city where this little girl lives and kind of stake out the situation and see if she can witness another exchange between mother-child, which is a little crazy, but it's also fiction. So,
I mean, and the scene is so bizarre, mm-hmm. and Amy, Emma's mother, mm-hmm. is just really horrible. I mean, Amy describes herself as losing control, losing her mind, and losing her life. Mm-hmm. And she seems to blame this five-year-old girl for everything that has gone wrong ever.
Yeah, and I mean, I think as mothers, I don't think we necessarily go around blaming our children, but I think she's a relatable character, a real character, in that if you're unhappy with yourself in any way, whether that's your weight, your looks, your job, your day-to-day, I think that plays into your happiness on a daily basis. I mean, a lot of times if you're unhappy, you'll blame your partner. You will get angry at your kids. You'll lose your temper if you're not happy in your job, if you don't have any sort of outlet. This woman has no outlet. She has no positive outlets in her life. I don't really feel like she has any joy or anything to really look forward to. And I've known moms like that. I mean, I empathize with Amy more in this book than I do with Sarah, quite honestly, because I am a mother to a young child. I know the day-to-day struggles. I know how tough it can be at times and how overwhelmed we can feel if we're full-time working mothers. So she is taking it out, yes, on her child, but I think it's really more of unhappiness with herself.
And who she is.
And who she is and who she's become as a mother when she might not have wanted this life for herself. But I feel like she's really thinking about her life as a circumstance, and her unhappiness is a symptom of all of this. And Emma just happens to be this kind of beautiful, perfect little child, everything that she's not. And I think she's taking it out on her in all the wrong ways.
Well, do you think part of it was that she felt she had disappointed her own mother? Although her own mother didn't seem abusive.
No, I don't think her own mother was abusive. Her own mother was tough. She was a farmer. I think that her mother was very independent, didn't really need a lot. Amy's father died, and her mother didn't really need like a man around. She was also overweight, but she was a very sturdy woman, very strong woman, kind of didn't use excuses in any regard. And I think Amy kind of uses just the excuses of her life and maybe feels guilty that she wasn't as strong as her own mother and can't just handle this thing called motherhood with more grace and go day to day and just be happy. So I think she's really struggling with a lot of that.
Well, I found it interesting, though, that her son, mm-hmm. she did treat him like he was the perfect child.
Exactly.
You know, it's almost like she had a practice child with Emma and that didn't work out so well.
Exactly.
So maybe with Robbie, the little one, she's doing better.
Right. You know, you've heard about kids who feel like their parents had preferences over, you know, one child over the other. This is the problem child and this is the easy child, or this is the child that... You know, I mean, I'm kind of a product of that. I joke, like, I had a great childhood. My mother was amazing. My father was amazing. But my brother, who's older, easiest kid ever. I mean, never got grounded, never got in trouble, just easy peasy. And then I come along and I am just a handful in many ways. But, you know, I always compared myself to him in a lot of ways because he was so easy. But I was kind of the overachiever. And my parents did a really great job about treating us equally. But I think each child is different. And a parent's response to that child or that period of time is different, too. And for some strange reason, Amy and Emma just rub each other the wrong way. And they just don't connect as you would hope a mother and child would.
And after Sarah takes Emma, Sarah is happy, happy, happy. Do you think any of this had something to do with the relationship she had just gotten out of? Long-term relationship, really expected to be married and live happily ever after. Did that have something to do with this?
Sure, of course. I mean, Sarah is a seemingly simple character, but I think she has a lot more complexities and things that she didn't deal with. Obviously, if you're going to kidnap a child, you obviously have some underlying issues that need to be addressed. But she was abandoned by her own mother when she was a child, so she carries that baggage. Her father never stepped up to be the man that she needed, so she became very independent. She became successful. She put all of her attention into working, as a lot of women do today. I feel like we're kind of becoming more and more and more workaholics and really putting our all into it. And I don't feel like she needs a man in any way, but she really wanted this long-term relationship to work out. And when it didn't, she does feel unwanted and kind of unloved, as she did with her own mother. I mean, it's kind of their love story, really, this book, this love that this woman and this child have, even though they have no familial bonds. But I think that that kind of takes the place of Sarah's, you know, lost love and her longtime love. And she's found someone that she can love unconditionally, even though that child will never be hers and never belong to her. So I think Sarah's so used to conditional love. I don't think she's experienced truly unconditional love. And she's kind of set herself up again for conditional love because, I mean, this child does not belong to her. She's risking everything to take
absolutely everything.
So you have to be a little crazy to do that, I feel like.
Well, and she, like you say, she brought a lot of baggage to this. You know, the long-term relationship ended, but her mother's relationship with her. And she even said at one point she knew her father would have given anything to have his wife, her mother, back, even giving her up. So she feels like she's never had anybody. Do you think she sees Emma as herself, as that child?
100%. I mean, there's a scene where Sarah is taking Emma and something bad happens between Amy and the five-year-old, and it instantly shuttles Sarah back to her own childhood and kind of a similar instance. So I think she, in her mind, Sarah is trying to save this little five-year-old girl from being perpetually disappointed by her mother and possibly her father. Emma's father has a decent relationship with her, but he doesn't really pay attention to what's going on in the relationship at all. So I don't think Sarah even factors in the little baby brother or the dad. I think she just sees this mother and this maybe long life that's ahead of Emma, and she wants to give her the second chance that she never really had to have a good childhood.
Not many people would have the freedom like she does, owning her own company, being able to get away and actually be on the road. Mm-hmm. But she goes to Ethan's, her ex-lover's, place. Why on earth would she pick that?
I think that demonstrates that she's maybe not thinking things through. Like I said, she makes a lot of poor decisions throughout the book. And I think she thinks that this place is far enough away, no one's going to be there, and that she can just go. And I think she feels partly entitled to it. Like, this is partly my place. I spent this many years with this person. And rather than risking exposing them, checking into, you know, an Airbnb, which they do down the line, but I think she just wants to get her away from the world, away from Longview, Washington. Sarah wants to get away from Portland, and it's the first place that comes to mind. It's kind of spur of the moment, and she goes. Again, another terrible decision, but she makes it anyway. And I think, though her actions were somewhat premeditated, it also shows that she's not really thinking this through and is not making the best decisions along the way.
Well, I didn't know if maybe this played into her fantasy.
Sure, of course.
This relationship with Ethan, who was the one
Absolutely.
In her mind. But she broke it off with him.
Yeah, and I think that's Sarah's way of exerting control. So she is in this long-term relationship with Ethan. He has never proposed marriage, though she has found a ring. And then years go by and he never proposes. So I think some women can relate to this, being in a long-term relationship, waiting for something that may or may not ever happen. And rather than risk getting hurt and disappointed, if she's been hurt and disappointed when it comes to love in the past, she just chooses to end it. And she's the one that's in control with that. But yeah, when she takes Emma to the cabin, I'm sure in the back of her mind, she's playing out this fantasy. She's playing house, essentially, with someone else's kid.
I know. And then when Ethan shows up mm-hmm. with a girlfriend, you know, it's like, duh, what were you thinking?
Exactly.
Why would you not expect him to be there? And then I thought, well, maybe she wanted him to be there.
Yeah.
And if he saw her with this child in this glorious relationship, maybe he would come back.
She might be thinking that in one area of her mind. But I mean, I think the logical part of her brain realizes how ridiculous that is. And that's never going to happen. And, you know, it obviously doesn't happen that way. They don't end up happily ever after.
Well, Amy really puzzled me because mm-hmm. after Emma goes missing, they always suspect the parents.
Oh, yeah.
But she will not tell the truth about anything. Even knowing that her child is out there and may be in danger, she still will not tell the truth.
Yeah, and I mean, I think that speaks to a lot of who Amy is and what she keeps inside and how guilty she feels, but also I don't think deep down she really loves her child. As a mother, that is the saddest thing I can ever imagine, but I know it exists. I know there are tons of broken relationships between mothers and daughters. This is obviously a very exaggerated way for that to come to light. But there was a slap that happened. Amy, you know, slaps her child. There's a few instances of physical abuse. And I think she is so concerned with being guilty and having that finger pointed at her as, you know, a kidnapping suspect or possibly even a murder suspect, that she keeps it to herself. She doesn't think that's an important detail to tell them right off the bat.
And that's the reason I thought it was so telling. Emma does not protest. She goes willingly with
Absolutely.
This person that she's never seen before. She doesn't cry. She doesn't scream. She doesn't ask for her mommy, except for one time mm-hmm. she asks, is my mommy looking for me? Mm-hmm. And Sarah has to say, well, I don't know.
Yeah. And that's because she's afraid her mom's going to be mad that she's gone. So, I mean, I think even though this child is only 5 years old, I think it shows the pain that a parent can inflict upon a little one even that early on. And I think Emma is looking for any escape, even if it doesn't register in her brain probably what's truly happening and that she's truly being taken away from her family. I think she's probably just looking to be not yelled at and screamed at and hurt in any way and just kind of be for a while.
And I think, as Sarah says, she just wants to give her one normal day, mm-hmm. you know, and then it turns into
yes.
a series of normal days that
right.
go on.
Right. And, you know, it's interesting in this day and age because we are in 2018. I think a lot of people think you could never get away with a kidnapping in this day and age with technology. I wanted to kind of pose the question that may absolutely be true, but with so much going on, the Amber Alerts that you hear today, I mean, do you even think about them tomorrow? There's just like news goes so fast. There's so much that I think in Sarah's mind, she maybe thought she could get away with it, that it would just kind of become old news very quickly.
Well, and I think you even quoted how many people go missing every year. It's over 800,000.
800,000, yeah. At the time that I was researching that, that might even be different because that was, what, 2016? So yeah, it could be different now. But that's an insane amount of children. It's horrifying.
It is. But like you say, how much attention do you pay?
Not that much.
The airport incident with the little girl stood out in your mind because it was so out of the norm of what you would have expected.
Yes.
And you could empathize with that to a certain degree. But, I mean, what if you hadn't remembered it?
Yeah.
You know?
Absolutely. Absolutely.
You and get, I mean, so busy that.
You do. And I mean, I still think about that little girl today and just wonder, you know, is she okay? You know, was her mother just having a bad day? Is she going to grow up in this just super toxic environment? And since then, I've witnessed two physically abusive instances between mothers and children in public places. One, the police were actually called. And the second one was in a locker room at the YMCA. And the woman was hitting her child in front of everyone. And I actually said something. And I think that that's very tricky because, you know, that's a mother. She has a right to spank her child if and, you know, when she decides to do that. So is it ever okay to intervene or say something or speak up? It's, again, it's such a tricky subject.
Well, and you don't know what you're opening
you
up
don't.
For yourself.
Completely.
I mean, if somebody abuses a child physically, they can turn on you physically.
Absolutely
too.
Absolutely, they can.
And how do you handle that situation?
Right.
And you don't know, like you say, if that's just one bad happenstance,
right.
You know, that was just, you're at the end of the rope.
Completely. And that was my question when I saw the real mom and the real little girl, Emma, was, you know, if she's doing this in public, then what's happening behind closed doors? Or was it just a symptom of being in an airport and you're running late, you have a toddler and a husband and baggage and you're annoyed with your child who's not doing anything at all? I mean, that was the strange thing, is this little girl was not doing anything at all. She wasn't bothering her mother in any way. It was just kind of, I felt like she was almost the little punching bag. It just really stuck with me.
I can tell.
Yeah.
It really has.
It did. It did.
And it got a great book out of it.
Well, thanks.
So, yeah. Sarah, at some point, starts to question her own intentions toward Emma, if she is really, and even thinks about what she could have done, should have done. Why didn't she report what she saw to the school? Why didn't the school do anything?
I mean, that's a really good point. I think, first things first, if I had done that in the book, there would be no book, essentially. I mean, it would have been a totally different story. Under normal circumstances, yes, I think reporting that kind of behavior to a school or to authorities, which she kind of thinks about and goes through. But, you know, she doesn't have any sort of relationship with this child. She does not know the day-to-day. And I think, for the purposes of the story, she didn't do that. But in real life, you know, I think that would be a logical next step, is to kind of question the school. But even so, the school didn't really seem to know what was going on or have any sort of reports. And, you know, my child goes to a Montessori and they have bumps,
oh,
bruises.
Absolutely.
I mean, they're dirty, like, you know, covered in dirt, and because they're playing all day. And, you know, I think that if a child is not complaining or not showing a lot of signs or symptoms of, you know, not communicating properly or showing something that could be going on at home, then the, you know, school might not even question anything about that child.
Why does Amy constantly blame everybody else for what's going on around her? She seems to have that personality.
Sure. I mean, I think a lot of people do that. And I think she is such a complicated, flawed character. And I know a lot of people and have been that person in the past where if you're not living the life that you want, you're blaming it on everything else or your circumstances or just what's going on around you instead of taking a good, long, hard look at yourself and what you're not doing right. I think that's just kind of become her life and a bad habit. I mean, I think a lot of people can relate to that, actually.
Now, you used before, during, and after. Why did you choose to write it that way?
It's funny. So even coming to write this book was just a really fast and furious process. I hadn't touched fiction in about a decade. I played around with a little, you know, a few little stories. I had written nonfiction. I have 4 nonfiction books published. But when I saw this exchange, I knew I had to write this story. So I went home. I gave myself an impossible deadline to write it in 8 weeks. And I wrote it in a month. And when I wrote the book, it came to me like that. It came to me in these little vivid snapshots. I saw it like a film first. I saw it as a movie in my head. And I knew I wanted to start kind of during this kidnapping. We know a child's been kidnapped. We don't really know all the circumstances. And then I wanted to just have these little scenes, essentially, that where we get to know the character before this incident happens, and then we see the action during, and then we get to kind of see what happens after the kidnapping. And for some reason, it just came out that way, and the editor liked it, so we kind of kept it that way.
Well, I didn't know if you had written like all the befores and all the durings, and then just kind of spliced them together.
That's... No, I mean, it's funny, when I first wrote the book, when I got my agent, it was just from Sarah's point of view. There was no Amy in this book, which was a totally different book. It was first person. It was very close. And then we started kind of talking and looking through it. And we're like, you know, it would be really interesting to see this mother on the page and kind of just follow the story from her perspective, too. So I feel like when we did that, it became a richer story and kind of shows two completely different characters, both making wrong decisions and having their own, you know, set of baggage. And this little girl, unfortunately, is kind of the pawn that moves the story along. But yeah, it kind of just came that way. I mean, we reshuffled some things along the way. I don't know. It's weird. When I sat down to write it, it just kind of came out that way.
Since writing the first book was such a condensed process and you gave yourself such a deadline, what has the second one been like? Is that same process in play?
No. Completely opposite. And a lot of authors will joke about this, like the first book's great because there are no, you know, you don't have a deal yet. You're writing for yourself. You're just, all the rules go out the window. Second book, totally different experience. I had to decide early on, because this book, Not Her Daughter, straddles the line between women's fiction and what they call domestic suspense. So I kind of had to decide, am I going to be a women's fiction writer or am I going to be a domestic suspense writer? So I chose the latter. I chose to go more the suspense route. And the second book has gone through so many iterations. I think the bad guys changed like 4 times. It has been a much more laborious process because I am thinking about the reader more. I am thinking about this genre more. I'm thinking about plausibility more. It's kind of, we're orchestrating this story a little bit more than we did with Not Her Daughter. And I think the second book's always harder because you have a deadline. You do have an audience. You have expectations. So it's been a different process. The third book, which I'm halfway into, has been much like the first. Like, again, rules go out the window. It's coming so much quicker. So the second book's been a labor of love, but I hope it'll all be worth it.
I didn't realize that you had to pick where you wanted to be.
Yeah, I mean, I don't think all writers have to. I mean, some writers write all kinds of different things, but when you're starting out, kind of sticking to a genre helps build, you know, credibility in that area. So it was kind of a hard choice because I love reading both, and domestic suspense is kind of this, it's a little bit of a newer genre. It's really taken off for a lot of writers. So I'm having fun with it and hope to stay.
How did you decide that you wanted to get back into fiction?
So I went to school for fiction writing, Columbia College Chicago, and always wanted to write books. And then for some strange reason, when I graduated, I just got into journalism. And I was a ghostwriter for a woman in Switzerland. I wrote, you know, magazine articles, blogs. I was a journalist on death row for 3 different cases, which was awesome. I'm so fascinated by true crime. And then I've always been into health and wellness and wanted to kind of parlay my love of writing with health and wellness and exercise, but it never satisfied that urge. It's funny, I wanted to write books, but then I wrote everything but I don't feel like until I became a mom and until I witnessed this specific instance that I had the right story that I wanted to tell, and it felt like the right time to just finally sit down and do it. So it kind of all worked out, but now I hope this will be my new life.
Well, I read that you did it in 8 weeks, but you actually gave up one job of the 3 that you were working.
Oh, I actually gave up 2 jobs of the 3. Yeah, so I had 3 jobs at the time. I mean, I was, you know, and at the time I was not being the best mom ever because I was working so much. Every time my daughter came home from school, I was on my computer just working. And yeah, I gave myself this 8-week deadline. When I got home, I quit 2 of my jobs immediately because I'm an all or nothing person. I would never recommend doing that, but it's just what I had to do to get it done. And then I actually only had 8 weeks on this corporate content manager contract that I was on where I was getting paid for it. So I gave myself 8 weeks. I wrote it in 4 weeks and then got the two-book deal and movie deal. It was a while after that, but it was the first time that I just didn't give myself a plan B or a second option or an out. I said, you know, this is going to happen, and luckily it did.
Well, you have to feel like you're on a merry-go-round, though. I mean, it's happened so fast.
It has happened so fast.
And a two-book deal, not just a one-book deal, but two books and a movie.
Yeah, and it's funny because the book's been out for 2 weeks, and it's, you know, it's been this long lead time. Like, it was very short period writing the book, so fast and furious, got the agent very quickly. We sold the book really quickly. And then, you know, then it's a year and a half essentially of waiting, or about a year of waiting. And so I really tried to, you know, build up social media and get the buzz out. And I hired a publicist, and, you know, we were counting down the days and months, and now it's been out for 2 weeks. And I joke, it's like anticipating Christmas, and then it's out, and it's like, oh, okay, yeah, now onto the next book. So it has been such a fast and furious ride. I haven't even really gotten to kind of sit and absorb it. I had a full-time job the entire time after writing this book. I became the editorial director of a branding agency. So my job all day, every day, is to write for other people. I have about 20 clients, and I actually decided to not do that anymore. And I'm going to just be writing book proposals for clients, which I also do on the side, and really focus on my own writing first and then writing for other people second for the first time ever. So I'm super excited about that.
Well, do you think that a good book proposal is the key?
For nonfiction. So the differences between, fiction and nonfiction. For fiction, you have to write the book, finish the book before you ever can sell the book, before you get an agent, or if you're going directly to a publisher, if it's a smaller publisher. For nonfiction, not always, but usually you just sell the idea for the book, which is in a 30 to 50 page book proposal document. I've written countless book proposals for clients, and it's one thing that I just absolutely love to do. I mean, it's a ton of research, a ton of just, you know, really going through the book proposal and making sure you have a marketable idea, making sure the person who's writing it has a digital presence, which goes hand in hand with the branding agency I work for. So they're two totally different beasts, but I love them both.
Well, that's good that you have avenues that you can pursue in both.
Absolutely.
In, you know.
Yeah, so I it's not all dependent on.
That's what
on
I was going to say. I'm such a safety kind of person.
Absolutely.
You know?
I mean, I always joke, like, don't quit your day job until you're actually making money as a writer, because I'm just of the belief that you don't want to put pressure on yourself to have to make ends meet that way until you hopefully are able to one day. So I always think it's nice to have another avenue of income.
Well, you've gotten some really good reviews and some good quotes, you know, for the book. What's your favorite?
Ooh, gosh, that's so hard. I mean, I love Chevy Stevens, which is on the front of the book. We were so fortunate to get just so many amazing blurbs from well-respected authors and New York Times bestselling authors, a lot of them that didn't even make it on the book. But I think any that we got, I mean, they were kind of all similar about questioning this right or wrong and taking something that's very black and white, like kidnapping, and kind of turning it on its head. And my favorite thing from readers or reviewers has been them saying, like, oh my God, I was siding with a kidnapper, and what would I do in this situation? And I've never thought about it like this. So for the people who really got the book, they truly got it. And reviews, most of these reviews from readers are like 4 or 5 paragraphs long, whether they loved it or hated it. And I love that it's sparking conversation. So I don't know if I could choose just one, but I would really love the one that made it on the front cover of the book.
Well, you said that there's lots of people that have different opinions.
Yes.
Has anybody been disappointed by the ending?
Oh, yes. Yeah. It's interesting because I went back and forth with my editor about the ending. We had two different endings, and I kind of wanted one, and she kind of wanted the other one, and we ended up going with this one. But when I first wrote this was supposed to be a sequel. There's supposed to be a sequel to it. One publisher wanted the sequel, and St. Martin's did not. They wanted this to be a standalone book. So I ended up going with St. Martin's. I'm so glad I did, but I always knew that there was more to this story. I think where the book ends, there's a lot of questions still left unanswered, but I think that's okay, because I want readers to kind of wonder what will happen to these characters. And maybe I've had a lot of people like, please, you know, write a sequel, we want to know what happens. And, you know, if it does well, maybe a few years down the line, it's something we can revisit, because I would love to revisit these characters and see what really happens to them and how they all end up.
I would like that as well.
Yeah, me too. Me too.
I got to the end and then I saw, oh, there's an epilogue. And I thought, oh, this is going to wrap it all up. Yeah. It's going to tell me about that. And it didn't.
Yeah, I know.
It was like, oh, man.
If there's been disappointment with the book, it's been definitely because of the ending, or it's not realistic, or which... You know, of course, it's fiction. There's a lot of things that aren't realistic, or there's just a lot of questions, and that's partly intentional. But yeah, I mean, it is what it is.
Well, the character Sarah does her Facebook thing where you go in and you pick your celebrity lookalike or whatever.
Yep.
So will Anne Hathaway be the lead role?
Well, I did that on purpose. But so with the production company Argent Pictures, who optioned this book, they're so incredible. And I think that they will do amazing things. When I wrote the book early on, before I got a book deal or anything, my husband, who again is a designer, he made a little casting board for me because I always saw this as a movie first. So he put the pictures for all the actors for each of the characters, which was so, so fun. And Anne Hathaway was up there, or the woman who's from Glow. She's the main character from Glow, this TV show. I think she could play Sarah. But I've always had one person in mind for Amy that I've seen her from the very beginning, is actually Melissa McCarthy, who is a comedian. She is a comic actress, but I think this could be such a dramatic breakout role for her. She's actually a very good actress and has never been in a serious role. I could just see her in this role so clearly.
Anybody come forward and said, oh, well, my child was kidnapped, so have you had any?
No, I've had none, though I had a kidnapping scare of my own with my daughter right after I wrote this book. And I was like, I brought this on myself. But we actually had two, but one was really scary. I had just written this book. I was across town and had come out of a yoga class, of all things. So I was very, like, zen and relaxed. And my daughter goes to a pretty big school, actually. And at the time, I think she was only in pre-K. And I get a call from her school. You know, she was dropped off at 8 a.m. by my husband. You do not walk them to their classrooms, though. So he has to basically drop her and go. And I get a call at close to 2 in the afternoon saying that our daughter was absent from school that day. In that moment, I was just like, okay, this is it. She's gone. Someone's had, you know, 5-6 hours to get away with her. I could not get anyone from the school on the phone. So, I mean, I got my husband on the phone, like shaking, driving to school. She was obviously okay. No one had kidnapped her, but her teacher had not seen her that morning for some reason and marked her absent and just never changed it. And I was like, okay, you guys got to change your policy for that. But I was just like, let me see her. Let me make sure she's okay, because I know it can happen just like that. And then not long after that, we lost her in Target was there and then she wasn't. They locked the doors. They reviewed the tapes. We couldn't find her for 10 minutes. I scared her to death after that when we got her back. But I became ultra paranoid while writing this book. And even after writing the book, I remember going out in the backyard. She'd be playing. And all of a sudden, like, her swing was swinging, but she wasn't there and I couldn't find her anywhere. So I became probably too paranoid after writing this book.
I remember my son hiding in the clothes.
Yes.
It is the worst.
It is the worst feeling in the world.
Well, hopefully your next book won't be quite as...
Well, the next book's got some serious stuff. No kidnapping involved. The next book's much more of a psychological suspense, a lot more twists and turns and darkness, but it's been a lot of fun to write. Different to write, but a lot of fun.
Are you still working on that one, or is it...
So we are turning in final edits this week, actually. We have a title and a cover, actually, which I love, but it's called Because You're Mine, and it should come out next August. So I should be on, hopefully, a book a year path.
Well, great.
Yeah.
We'll look forward to seeing you again about this time next year.
I'm so excited.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
We've reached the end of our time today. I've been talking with Rhea Fry about her latest book, Not Her Daughter. The book explores the topic of kidnapping, and in this case, has 5-year-old Emma Grace been stolen or rescued? The book is published by St. Martin's Press. I'm Linda Lloyd, and this is Book Talk.
Thank you for joining us today. Book Talk is recorded in the studios of WIPL in Memphis, Tennessee. If you have any questions or comments, you can email us at wiplfm@gmail.com or write to us at Book Talk, care of WIPL, 3030 Poplar Avenue, Memphis, Tennessee, 38111, or call us at 901-415-2752.
This recording of Book Talk is licensed under the Creative Commons Attribution, Non-Commercial, No Derivative Works 3.0 license for the United States. You are free to share, copy, distribute, or display and perform this work. But there are restrictions. Nothing in this license impairs or restricts WYPL's moral rights. Thank you for listening to Book Talk.